I don't know what changes the Republicans will try to make in the Senate. I don't know what they don't like about the bill. They certainly haven't said they're not against it.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, we speak with U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York. Well, the Senate has been delivered the, quote, big beautiful bill from the House of Representatives, which approved President Trump's domestic agenda by one vote. The Senate says they want to get it done by July 4th. Minority Democrats are hoping to stop it. I spoke about that and much more with U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York. Here's our latest conversation. It's Ian Pickus. We are back in the Congressional Corner today with U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York, in this office since 2009. Senator Gillibrand, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ian. Appreciate it.
You know, we spoke after the election, but before the new Congress had started, and now we're past the 100-day benchmark and into the middle of the year. In your opinion, how is the new Trump administration going so far? What is your view of the actions that they've been taking so far?
I think President Trump has put forward a fairly toxic agenda that's really hurting working people across New York. I think he has overreached. He is doing things that I don't think people who voted for him expected. Not only has his tariffs meant higher prices for basics like groceries and clothes and household goods, but this reconciliation bill, this tax plan, is making both health care and groceries more expensive for Americans because it's slashing funding for Medicaid and food assistance. And it'll just finance more tax breaks for billionaires and rich companies. So I really feel that this is creating a growing backlash against Republicans and against Trump specifically that is really because of the decisions he's making and the policies he's trying to put forward.
Now, what is likely to be different in the Senate version of the quote-unquote big beautiful bill from what the House sent over to you all?
Well, I think that people should understand it as a big, beautiful betrayal of the middle class. It is really betraying the commitment that he made to getting costs of groceries and housing down. It's betraying his commitment to not touch health care like Medicaid. And I think it's just going to make life much worse for Americans. I think that this bill is very, very harmful because it takes 8.6 million people off of Medicaid. That's seniors, that's veterans, that's people with disabilities, it's pregnant women and women, and it's children. It also cuts a lot of access to health care through Obamacare, taking away the support that people who earn low incomes had to access health care. So over 10 million people are going to lose access to health care because of this.
Do you think that the deadline of July 4th that the Republicans in the Senate are talking about will be feasible to pass this bill?
I don't know. I don't know what changes the Republicans will try to make in the Senate. I don't know what they don't like about the bill. They certainly haven't said they're not against it. So I just don't know. It depends how much it divides their caucus. But knowing this Republican Party who has not stood up to President Trump and knowing that the Senate has not been standing up to Trump, I think it does get done before July 4th.
Mm-hmm. So this idea that there are three or four who might have their issues, but you don't see enough of them holding out to stop it.
That's what I think. I think that they've not shown courage. They've not shown strong spines in the past. I just don't think they're going to stand up to Trump.
So let me go back to something you said about the tax part of this bill. You know, and this isn't just Democrats saying this, but the independent scorers who look at it say the tables show that the tax cuts overwhelmingly go to, you know, the upper crust, not the middle or lower income earners. And you're saying that you think Republicans will face a backlash to that, but probably not in time to stop the passage and signing of the bill. So do you think there actually will be a political price to pay, given that this message seems to be different from what he ran on?
Yeah, the wealthiest Americans are going to see the vast majority of the benefits of this bill. They're going to pay for tax cuts for billionaires by cutting food benefits and health care benefits for working people. And American families will lose and billionaires will win. I think it's the most significant overreach by a president since 2006, when President Bush tried to privatize Social Security, when he was mired in Iraq, when there was a culture of corruption in Washington. And that resulted in 30 House seats flipping and 6 Senate seats flipping. It feels the same way. And that was the year, I think you remember, Ian, that I first ran for Congress. It was 2006. Yeah. And because of that Republican overreach, I won a 2-to-1 Republican district that hadn't been Democrat since the Nixon administration.
So you think Democrats will be able to pick up the pieces from last year in the midterms based on where we are right now?
I do. I think it's important that we are in our districts and in our states listening to people, understanding what's on their minds, understanding what they're distressed and upset about. And I can tell you from my time all across the state, they are really mad about these Medicaid cuts. The hands off our Medicaid, our hands off Social Security, hands off the VA. Those marches were across our state and were really powerful and impactful. And they were cross-party. It wasn't just Democrats marching. Many Republicans, many independents do not like these kinds of cuts. They are so harmful to the agreement that we've made long ago that we are going to help people who need access to health care, our individuals with disabilities, our families with small children, pregnant women who just need that support pre and post birth. They need support of nutrition, all the nutrition assistance. You know, when I travel the state, no one thinks it's smart to let children go hungry. No one thinks it's smart to let our seniors not have enough food to eat. And they support their local food banks and they support food pantries, and they want the federal government to invest in food security, and that's what the SNAP program does. It invests in food security so our kids can think when they go to school and our seniors don't, you know, die alone and hungry. It's why organizations like Meals on Wheels are so popular, because they bring home cooked meals to seniors who aren't being visited by anybody. It might be the only human face they see in a week. So cutting those types of programs is really against the fabric of our communities, against the fabric of our American values. And I think there will be a very significant backlash as a result.
What do you say to the prevailing argument from the administration and its allies in Congress that the programs like the ones you're talking about are rife with corruption and, you know, freeloading and people who shouldn't be getting the benefits, who are getting the benefits, and their approach has been to, you know, stop fraud and abuse, more or less?
I think they're misrepresenting the programs. I don't think they have the level of fraud and abuse that is resulting in 8.6 million people getting cut off Medicaid. I'm happy to support any reforms to make the programs more transparent, more accountable, more effective. And we stand ready to do that work. But that's not what this is. This is a meat cleaver cutting off the programs at the knees so that they can't perform in the way they are intended to. And I just don't think people with disabilities and our seniors and young children should pay the price of the fact that they are lazy. They're not actually doing the work of saying where exactly is there any fraud, corruption, or abuse and identify it. They're just cutting with a meat cleaver.
There have been very few mothers in the Senate in American history. You're one of them. And you mentioned childbirth a moment ago. You actually have a new initiative that would require the cost of childbirth to be covered by insurance. So how likely are you to see that reform get to the finish line?
I think it's very possible because it's bipartisan. We started negotiating with a group of Democrats and Republicans. And what it does is just acknowledge that having children is very expensive and has a lot of health care needs and a lot of out-of-pocket costs. Labor, delivery are very expensive. A lot of families, a lot of mothers need C-sections. If you had to pay for a C-section out of pocket, it's $12,000. Even a regular birth can cost up to $8,000. And so we think the average out-of-pocket cost that a new parent is paying is about $3,000. And so what this bill does is it tells insurance companies that they have to cover ultrasounds, delivery services, anesthesiology, fetal monitoring, consultations with specialists, specialists, postpartum care for conditions caused or exacerbated by pregnancy, such as diabetes or hypertension or obesity or postpartum depression and anxiety, care for miscarriages. So all this now has to be covered by insurance companies as basic care. It can't be extra add-ons. And we think this is a great bipartisan effort to make the challenges of having children just a little easier because, you know, these are our families. You know, if you're a working family who doesn't have a lot of extra income, it shouldn't be that you can't afford to have a child. You should be able to have a child if you want to have that child and be able to afford the basic necessities of giving birth.
Let me just reintroduce you. We're speaking with U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York, on the Congressional Corner today. So, Senator, obviously you represent a big border state. First of all, what do you think of the president's tariff policies? And second, what have been the impacts on New York State as you see them?
So, you know, tariffs is a highly complex tool that we have in negotiating with other countries to make sure that we can protect the products we make and the services we deliver in the United States. But that's not what Trump has been looking at. Trump has just been using tariffs as a negotiating tactic, creating chaos for all companies that buy and sell goods throughout New York, and creating chaos for families. I could understand targeted, strategic, surgical tariffs on things that we want to protect, like U.S. manufactured cars, for example. But that's not what these are. These are across-the-board punitive tariffs on countries that we buy things from. It's not that they're somehow taking advantage of us. We want to buy things from what those countries are producing. It's where we get certain key inputs for our own manufacturing or key deliverables for, you know, the U.S. And so he's just created a trade war that is raising inflation. The cost of everything is going up. It's depressing growth. It's shrinking our economy. And Moody's just downgraded the U.S. rating because of it. So he clearly doesn't understand what a tariff is supposed to do. He's using it as a bullying position. He's not using it as the trade policy that it's meant to be. And he's harming us. So I would say the trade war that Trump has created has been devastating for New York.
You know, you obviously are familiar with upstate New York and northern New York from your time as a senator and before that. And if the Canadian tourism is depressed the way that we're hearing it's going to be, it's likely to have a significant impact on the upstate economy. Is there anything that you're working on in that vein to help some of the areas that are really counting on that cross-border traffic?
So one thing I'm doing is standing up to Trump to try to tell the world community is that this does not represent American values, and that Canada's upset because Trump has put on horrific tariffs to a friend and ally when he should know that our border transactions are reliant on each other. We have manufacturing in the U.S. that's based on inputs from Canada, and Canada has manufacturing that's based on inputs from New York. And so we have a very, very favorable and positive ecosystem with Canada. And what Trump has done is disregarded that and created a trade war and insulted the Canadian people and the Canadian government over and over again. Again, acting like a child and like a bully for no reason. And as a consequence, they're offended and they're upset and it's hurt their businesses. And so the reason why they don't want to come to the United States is because they're mad and they're frustrated. And so what we've tried to do is stand up to Trump. In fact, we got a bipartisan coalition of four Republicans to join us in blocking some of the tariffs with Canada to tell the president that he could not do this. And so we are trying to stand up so that at least Canadians know regular New Yorkers and regular American people are not against Canadians, and that we want to continue to trade with them. We want to continue to have investment in each other. We want to have tourism. We want school trips. We want businesses to work together, cross borders. And so we're just trying to show them by our actions that we do really want to have this strong relationship despite the words of our president.
Let me change gears and ask you about your work as the ranking member on the Committee on Aging. And you've got a focus of late on a problem on our farms, which is the aging farm workforce. What's the issue and how do we solve it?
So tomorrow in the Aging Committee, we're going to have a hearing on exactly that. It's called the Aging Farm Workforce, America's Vanishing Family Farms. And the hearing is going to highlight the crisis that American farmers are aging, causing a decline in family farms. More than 30% of farmers are older than 65 years old, and the aging farm workforce presents a challenge for both safety and food security. This will be interesting. We'll have some witnesses. We're going to have Zippy Duval, who's the president of the American Farm Bureau Federation since 2016. He's very knowledgeable about farm policy. And then we're going to have Jim Alderman, who represents farmers in Florida, a vegetable farmer. And we're going to have Aaron Locker, who is basically a recruiter who is focused on how do you serve organizations within the food and agriculture industry. And so he'll have a lot of data about that. And then we'll have Chris Wolf, who is a professor of agriculture economics from Cornell. And so he will talk to us about research and data and information about what's happening on dairy farms, dairy markets, farm risk management, which I think is really important. Farms are essential to our upstate economy. It's really important that they continue to thrive for generations. We've been highlighting some of the challenges in farming for a while now. We had hearings about the suicide rate for a lot of farmers who are feeling that they can't make ends meet, that they, no matter how hard they try, they can't produce the goods that they would normally produce, and that the stresses of being at the forefront of agriculture is very, very unsettling. And so one of the things that I want to focus on is, as we talk about how do we lower food costs, one of the ways we can lower food costs is investing in our agricultural sector, invest in farms, make it more affordable to be a farmer, make it more affordable to produce low-cost goods for American families. We need to invest in our agriculture and our rural areas. And so this hearing will be more inputs on some legislation that I'm working on about how do we get food costs down by investing in our farmers.
I have just enough time to ask you a couple of political questions before we go. First of all, we just got through a big election, but it's June, and that means there are these Democratic primaries coming up. Wondering if you plan to make an endorsement in the New York City mayoral race or the Albany mayoral race?
No, I'm very excited for New York voters to make decisions about who they want to lead their cities. I think we have strong candidates in both races, and we're very lucky to have so many public servants who want to serve and want to make a difference. So I'm excited to vote in the Albany mayor's race, and I will be quietly supportive of the entire field in New York. So I'm not going to endorse, but I think we have a real blessing of many good candidates.
Have you decided who you'll vote for in Albany?
I actually have not. I have to give it some serious thought. There's so many great candidates. One of the candidates actually knocked on my door 2 weeks ago when I was home.
Me too.
Which was a delight. So Dorsey Applers came to my door, which I thought was pretty kind of her. And so I got to talk to her and talk to her about her vision for the city. But I think we have a great deal of really talented candidates that I'm very excited about in Albany.
I have this job, which means I'm not a registered member of a party, and they were not as excited to talk to me as I imagine they were to talk to you, Senator. Lastly, what do you think about Lieutenant Governor Delgado announcing he will challenge Governor Hochul next year?
Well, I fully support our governor. She has done an excellent job in trying to bring our state back together again. She's really been investing in the economy. She wants to help working people thrive. She's also focused on things that I care deeply about, like mental health, public safety, dealing with the border crisis, dealing with the fentanyl trade, making sure we have a stronger economy and get the cost of groceries, the cost of housing, and the cost of food and medicines down. So I just support the work she's been trying to do on a bipartisan basis across the state to bring us back together again. And I think she's been a formidable and very effective leader.
We've been speaking with New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat. Senator Gillibrand, thank you so much for speaking with us and our listeners, and we're looking forward to the next time around.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you very much. Thanks, Ian.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.